For every foreign news story in 2011, there were journalists there to report it, which means that many journalists found themselves in hair-raising situations this past year. There were wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, and of course, violent protests throughout the Middle East. But some of the most dangerous places for journalists in 2011 are places that didn't get as much coverage. The Philippines, Brazil, and Peru earned spots on the list of top 20th deadly countries for journalists this year. The Committee to Protect Journalists published that list, and here to tell us more about it is their executive director, Joel Simon. Joel, welcome to the program.
It's great to be on, Jackie.
So please tell me about 2011 overall. Has it been an especially bad year for journalists?
Yes, particularly if you look at the number of journalists who are in prison. That's our annual tally recorded 179 journalists in jail around the world. That's a 20% increase over the year before. And while the number of journalists killed has not gone up at 43, it's been a difficult and dangerous year.
Let me talk to you for a moment about the places on this list that are perhaps a bit surprising or don't get as much coverage. For example, the Philippines ranks number 5.
Right.
Hasn't been in the news nearly as much as Syria, which on your list is number 20.
Well, the Philippines is extraordinarily violent and dangerous for reporters. And in fact, the most deadly incidents ever recorded by CPJ took place in 2009 in Mindanao, in a town called Maguindanao. And 32 journalists and media workers were killed in a systematic massacre. That's the most deadly incident we've ever recorded. And year after year, there's a record of impunity for the killers of journalists in the Philippines. So it may not make the headlines year after year, but the toll of violence continues.
Joel, which beats are considered to be the most dangerous? Apparently, it's not necessarily war reporting.
Well, the reality is that most journalists who are killed are journalists working in their own countries, covering things like human rights violations and crime and corruption. And I think that what's important to do is sort of take a step back and think about the role that these journalists play, not only in informing people within their own country, but informing a global audience. The people providing this information are local journalists working in their country. They're freelancers. They're often online journalists. Sometimes they're employees of international news organizations. And they are the most vulnerable. They are the ones who appear, unfortunately, on this list of journalists killed, of journalists imprisoned. And they're the ones who most need our support.
That was Joel Simon, director of the Committee to Protect Journalists. Joel, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you so much.
You're listening to NPR News. Most U.S. manufacturing came back strongly this year. Nowhere was that more evident than across the Midwest. But even if it was a good year for industry, not all of the jobs lost during the recent recession returned. Nyla Boudou of Changing Gears has the story for our series, A Good Year.
Chicago White Metal Casting's CEO Eric Treiber is leading me onto his factory floor, where workers are busy making small aluminum, zinc, and magnesium metal parts.
Oh, they're making parts that'll go into cars, some parts that'll be used for a swimming pool. We're making components that'll go onto some farm equipment.
It's a whole lot louder in here than it was a few years ago. Revenue's up 4% over 2010, which reflected an increase from 2009. Those numbers are being repeated at factories across the Midwest.
We're seeing a great demand for some of the machinery that's made right here in the Midwest.
That's Bill Strauss, a senior economist with the Federal Reserve Bank of Chicago. He's talking about not just small parts, but cars, tractors, mining equipment, and steel. As the Fed measures it, Midwestern manufacturing has enjoyed 28 months of growth at rates much better than the national average and the overall economy.
The kind of goods that we produce here are very high value-added goods. You know, we have the Caterpillar 797B made here in the state of Illinois. It's the largest truck made in the world, weighing over 1 million pounds, costing, you know, a neighborhood of $7-8 million.
Imagine how much steel goes into that. So with all those orders, where are the jobs? During the recession, one out of every four jobs lost was in manufacturing. That's 2.3 million jobs. As of last November, though, just 308,000 had returned. Why so few? Remember the mantra, produce more with less? Many manufacturers practically perfected that during this recession. Take Chicago White Metal Casting. Triber says they had to be focused on productivity in order to keep up with overseas competition, so they updated machines, focused on staff training, and improved quality control. And Triber is actually hiring, but he's looking for specialists like die-cast machinists. And that's the problem right now with manufacturing. With better productivity, the need is for more skilled workers. Not just machinists, but welders, designers, and most of all, people who know how to operate the new computerized machines on factory floors, CNC workers. Economist Bill Strauss.
What about the 2 million that lost jobs? Can't you hire those back? And what you find out from people is that even though they were classified as being in manufacturing, many of them lack the kind of skills that are required in this more 21st century manufacturing.
Strauss says he's optimistic that the manufacturing sector will continue to do well in the coming year. But he also says it will need more workers who have the exact skills needed to do the new jobs. For NPR News, I'm Nyla Boodoo in Chicago.
This is NPR News. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Jackie Lydon. In February of the new year, the British will prepare a major celebration. It's not another royal wedding. It's the Diamond Jubilee of Queen Elizabeth II, marking the 60th anniversary of her accession to the throne. It's an exceptionally long reign. Only one other British monarch has reigned as long, Her Royal Majesty Queen Victoria. In 6 decades, Queen Elizabeth's reign has spanned 12 British prime ministers, 12 American presidents, and 6 popes. She's one of the world's most famous women, instantly recognizable and eternally private. Journalist Andrew Marr has written a new book about Queen Elizabeth II. It's called The Real Elizabeth, An Intimate Portrait of Queen Elizabeth II, after many interviews with those closest to the Queen, including her friends, advisors, and her children. Andrew Marr now joins us from our studios at the BBC in London. Andrew Marr, it's a real pleasure to have you with us.
It's great to be talking to you, Jackie.
You know, it's fascinating to read through this book, a woman about which you think you know a lot, and then... go into all the details, almost a pointless picture of how she becomes who she is. For example, we think of her as a figurehead, a unique symbol, but you say that that is really a difficult job.
It's a lot harder, perhaps, than it looks. Every single day of the year, except for Christmas Day and sometimes Easter Day, the Queen sits down and works her way through a great thick wodge of official papers. She reads all the most secret papers of the British state, all the stuff from the intelligence services and the rest of it. In Whitehall, they call her reader number one. She does that. She travels around the world a lot, really at the behest of the British government as part of the sort of trade and diplomatic mission that goes on. She is travelling all the time around the country, going to small towns and hospitals and police stations and so on. And she does this year in, year out. Of course, she has wonderful palaces and lots of luxury around her, but she works jolly hard.
And you say this stuff comes over from Whitehall in these red boxes. Everything is quite formal. So when the Queen receives these papers each morning, what does she do with that knowledge?
That's a very good question. What she does with it is that she questions ministers, ambassadors, above all the Prime Minister. And the Prime Minister at the moment, David Cameron, said to me, he said, what's really useful for me is that I'm in all sorts of arenas and forums all the time being asked questions. But here, once a week, in complete privacy, I'm being asked, what do you really intend to do? Why have you done that? What is your thinking about this? By somebody who has great knowledge, not only of what's happening right now, but what happened before.
Remind us of how big the realm is, the former and current realm.
Well, she's Queen, of course, of the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland. But let's remember that she's Queen of Australia. She's Queen of Canada. And indeed, as head of the Commonwealth, she's head of an organisation which represents around a third of the globe's humanity.
She has to be the monarch at all times. She can never be spontaneous. And this, to many of us, makes her appear rather stiff.
She is the exact opposite of everything in the modern age we are taught that a sort of celebrity or a public figure should be. When we're all encouraged to be outgoing, heart on our sleeve, emotional. If you're a public figure, people want to hear vivid and provocative and fresh language from you. And all of that is constitutionally forbidden to the Queen. Because if she takes a strong view about something, or says something cutting or hurtful or mocking or whatever, then she is speaking on behalf of the British state, and that's just not acceptable. Her job is to be the figurehead.
Let's go back to a moment that summarises again who the Queen is in many ways, and that is the moment that she finds out that her father is dead. She's 25 years old, and she is going to ascend to the throne.
She had said goodbye to her father, who was ill but didn't seem mortally ill at all, and she was in Kenya as part of what was going to be a very long tour, going off to Australia and New Zealand, in place of her father, who was too ill to do that tour. And then suddenly this blow falls. But she didn't make a scene, she didn't complain, she simply apologised to everybody for the disruption that this was going to cause, and the fact the tour had to be cancelled, and wrote lots of letters of apology, and set off home. Though it said that she was crying as the plane set off for England, and then she landed, and there, waiting for her on the tarmac, with great big, sort of slightly sinister-looking official limousines clustered around them, there's Winston Churchill, there's all the senior politicians, waiting for this very slight, small, 25-year-old woman. From then on, as she touches the tarmac, her entire life is different. Her entire life is ruled by ritual and the demands of the British state.
You know, you write that for her, this is almost like a religious vocation, because she is representing, as you say, the people. So that when the different premierships or parliaments come to grief, she is there as a representative, well, of her subjects.
I think it's not an almost religious thing for her. I think it is a religious thing. I think she feels that she was God-called, that this is a religious vocation as well as a political one. Very interesting. At the time of her coronation, she insisted that it be televised and filmed, against the advice of many ministers and courtiers and others. She said no, she wanted to be crowned in sight of all her subjects. But there was one moment of the ceremony which was never filmed and never seen, and that was the moment when she was anointed with oil by the Archbishop and became Queen. That was, if you like, the God-called moment. And I think she still regards herself quite literally as put there on behalf of all the British people by God. And I don't think it is a metaphor for her or a simile. I think it's what she really believes.
Andrew Marr's book is called The Real Elizabeth, An Intimate Portrait of Queen Elizabeth II, comes out next week. Thank you so very much.
Thank you very much indeed for talking to me.
Tonight, New York's Metropolitan Opera will premiere a new piece with music that's hundreds of years old. It's called The Enchanted Island, and it features arias by several Baroque composers, including Handel and Vivaldi, and mashes up the plots from two Shakespeare plays. And, oh yes, it stars Placido Domingo as the sea god Neptune. Jeff London has still more.
On Broadway, it would be called a jukebox musical. Take a bunch of tunes from, say, ABBA, write a plot around them, and voila, you have Mamma Mia. In opera, it's called a pasticcio, and according to Jeremy Sams, the creator of The Enchanted Island, the tradition goes all the way back to the beginning of the art form.
The very first important opera in the world ever, Coronazione di Poppea by Monteverdi, is itself a pasticcio. There's all sorts of other hands at work in that piece.
The idea for The Enchanted Island came 5 years ago from the Metropolitan Opera's general manager, Peter Gelb, says director Phelan McDermott.
Peter suggested this idea to create this new piece, a pasticcio, from old pieces of Baroque music. Some of them well-known pieces, but some of them also kind of obscure little gems from operas that are less well-known.
Jeremy Sam says even before he came up with a plot, he listened to a lot of music written between 1650 and 1750. Handel, Vivaldi, Rameau, Purcell, a lot of music.
On my iTunes, I made a list of the things I had to have in the show at all costs. When I finished compiling that list, it said at the bottom, you have got 3 days of music.
As Sam's feasted on Baroque opera, he started having some clever dramatic ideas, says his collaborator, Phelan McDermott.
Jeremy's sewn together this wonderful kind of beast, which has a great story. It's a mashup of Midsummer Night's Dream and The Tempest. the lovers from Midsummer Night's Dream washed up on Prospero's Island and ensuing complications from that.
So this new libretto, with lyrics in English, has characters from one play falling in love with characters from the other. Colorchura soprano Danielle Denise plays Ariel, the sprite enslaved by Prospero. She says her role, which was created especially for her, is a mashup itself.
You know, I'm sort of channeling a lot of Ariel in The Tempest, a lot of Puck from Midsummer Night's Dream, a little bit of Tinkerbell on the side. I mean, it's a great thing to be able to create a role, to create it from scratch.
I can conjure you fire from the heavens. I can conjure you fire from the heavens. I can make you a leaf full of flowers. But they won't be amazed at the powers. So whatever you want, which would you?
As a matter of fact, all the roles in The Enchanted Island have been tailored for the singers who are performing them. Jeremy Sam says he decided to make the lead role, Prospero, a countertenor, following Baroque tradition.
That is a defining voice, and particularly in the movement of countertenors in the last 20 years. They are virile, strong, emotional, wonderful creatures, marvelous creatures. And Prospero has that otherworldly, shamanic, magician, distant, yet feeling quality. It seemed to be right.
Luckily, one of the best countertenors in the business, David Daniels, was available and interested. There are other stars in the opera, mezzo-soprano Joyce DiDonato among them. But Jeremy Sam says as he was already in the middle of writing the piece, he was handed an operatic superstar on a platter, Plácido Domingo.
Peter Gelb asked Domingo to be part of the show, and he said yes, and he came to me and said, okay, we've got Domingo, what's he going to be? So that was the real turning point for me for so many ways, because I said immediately, without thinking, he should be the great god Neptune, because we're on an island. And I could sort of see him with seaweed and a trident, you know?
Hear me, respect me, hear me, for in my wrath I tend to wander.
Director Phelan McDermott says while The Enchanted Island may appear to be a hodgepodge, it all seems to be coming together as a whole. And he looks forward to this evening's premiere when an audience will hear all this old music in a new setting.
And in a strange way, it almost feels to me like a little bit of the feeling of what it must have been like the first time that they were heard. Because you're seeing in this new context, you're seeing them as if they've never been heard before.
The Enchanted Island opens at the Metropolitan Opera tonight. On January 21st, it will be broadcast in high definition in movie theaters around the world. For NPR News, I'm Jeff London in New York.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. Scott Simon returns next week. Happy New Year. I'm Jackie Leiden. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Jackie Leiden. How often have you thought, if only I could be in two places at once? Well, this year becomes more of a possibility by way of robots. While it's been a tough year for many of us humans, NPR's Laura Seidel reports for the NPR series A Good Year that it has been a good year for robots that stand in for humans.
Mike Fennelly isn't easily surprised by cutting-edge technologies, but when he started as an IT guy at a Silicon Valley startup called Evernote, there was a robot rolling around the office.
It was slightly disturbing for the not really knowing what the robot was for at the beginning and then going, oh, wait, okay, that's Phil.
CEO Phil Libin is also known as...
a robotic overlord.
Well, Libin isn't actually a robot, but when he is out of town, his robot is still keeping an eye on things.
Get back to work. That's the usual robot employee interaction.
The robot looks a little like a stick figure on wheels. Its bulbous head has two eyes, which are actually a camera and a laser. On its forehead is a screen where you can see Phil Libin's face, and Libin can see employees like Andrew Sinkoff.
You know, it's probably better than having him actually be right next to me.
Really?
No, I'm kidding. It's pretty cool. It's pretty cool. When he's not around, this is a good way to communicate with him.
Libin is actually in the office today. He's just showing me how the robot works. But he is often traveling to his company's other locations in Japan, Austin, and Zurich. His company makes products that help people remember everything from chores, names, appointments, to random thoughts. He says using the robot to stay connected to his home office is better than a video conference program like Skype, which connects to a computer stuck in one room.
Whereas with the robot, yeah, I can just, you know, I can roll around. I can roll into a meeting that somebody else is having. I can sort of say, hey, what are you guys talking about? I can go up and look at the whiteboard. I can point at things with the laser.
Libin purchased his robot from a company just down the street in Mountain View, California, called Anybot. When I arrive at the Anybot offices, I can't find the receptionist. Then I turn around and there's a robot in front of me.
I'm the receptionist here at Anybot, which is one of the services that we offer, which is called the AnyLobby service.
Angela is actually in South Carolina, but companies can buy a robot and rent her for a few hours at a time.
We can log in to several different locations all in one day and provide a plethora of different functions, you know.
Anybot was founded by Trevor Blackwell, who had been looking for a way to make robots popular. They've been searching for the, quote, killer app for robots. Don't think Terminator.
I'll be back.
Blackwell was looking for a program that would make robots popular the way spreadsheets popularized computers. He decided the key was robots that could help people be in two places at once.
And the need is there because travel gets more and more painful and expensive, especially overseas travel. So, you know, there are a lot of engineers here who are working with factories in Asia, and they need to see minute by minute what's going on there.
One of Anybot's telerobots costs about $15,000, which he points out is about the cost of one overseas trip. Ken Goldberg, a professor at UC Berkeley who teaches classes in robotics, thinks Blackwell may be onto something.
There's a lot of excitement because it seems to tap into this idea that we're increasingly busy.
Goldberg imagines that with our crazy schedules, many of us may find it useful to, say, send the robot to the office party while you're home with the kids.
Right now, we would consider it really weird and rude and inappropriate. But you could imagine that maybe after a while, that might be kind of okay. You're still there, right? You're spending time, but you're, you know, sitting in your pajamas at your desk.
Goldberg says just this year he saw several commercial companies like Anybot open up to sell what are called telepresence robots. According to Goldberg, the technology has finally reached the point where it's affordable, and with our busy lives, there's a growing need to do more, be in more places, see more people. But there is a downside, too. We may soon be in a world where there are no more excuses for not showing up. Laura Seidel, NPR News.